This is Ralph Nader, and you're listening to Radio Powered by the People, KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and across the globe at kpfk.org.
Thursday, January 22nd, I'm Max Pringle. Former special counsel Jack Smith testifies today in front of a congressional panel in D.C. and defends his prosecution of President Trump for fraud before a bitterly divided partisan committee. President Trump sets up his Board of Peace today with about a dozen signatories. Most of the major European powers, however, are notably absent. Governor Gavin Newsom doubles down on his criticism of the Trump administration in Davos, saying that the administration represents a real danger of authoritarianism in America. And ICE agents arrest a Minnesota 5-year-old, drawing heavy criticism from immigrant rights advocates. These stories and more coming up from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley. This is the Pacifica Evening News. I'm Max Pringle. Vice President J.D. Vance says the Insurrection Act won't be needed right now in Minneapolis after meeting with Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents in the city today, which has emerged as a national focal point in the clash over the Trump administration's immigration crackdown. The comment today seemed to echo a similar retreat by President Trump, who had threatened to invoke the rarely used federal law to quell persistent protests against federal agents in Minneapolis, which would have meant sending troops to the city, before telling reporters a week ago that there wasn't a reason to use the act right now. Former Justice Department Special Counsel Jack Smith defended his investigations of President Trump today at a public congressional hearing. Sagar Magani has more.
Former special counsel Jack Smith is defending his decisions to bring criminal charges against Donald Trump, saying investigations found proof beyond reasonable doubt of wrongdoing.
No one should be above the law in this country.
And at a House hearing.
And the law required that he be held to account.
Smith told lawmakers that's what he did, and politics had nothing to do with it. But as the hearing started,
it was always about politics.
Judiciary panel chair Jim Jordan.
The good chairman started by saying, it's all about the politics. Well, maybe for them, but for us, it's all about the rule of law.
And top Democrat Jamie Raskin, as the hearing split along partisan lines. Smith abandoned the cases after Trump retook the White House, citing longtime Justice Department legal opinions that sitting presidents cannot be indicted. Sagar Magani, Washington.
A massive winter storm is barreling toward the eastern U.S., threatening to bring severe ice and snow from Texas to Boston. Forecasters warn the storm could rival a hurricane in damage to power lines and trees, especially in areas with heavy ice. The storm is expected to start Friday in New Mexico and Texas, moving east through the south and then up the coast into New England. Bitterly cold air could follow, with wind chills dropping to minus 50 degrees Fahrenheit in parts of Minnesota and North Dakota. Utility workers are on alert, and supplies like bread and salt were reportedly flying off the shelves. The massive storm system is expected to bring a crippling ice storm with about 30 centimeters of snow from Oklahoma through Washington, D.C., New York, and Boston, and then a final punch of bitterly cold air that could drop wind chills to minus 50 degrees in parts of the Midwest. Forecasters are warning the damage, especially in areas pounded by ice, could rival a hurricane. The storm is expected to begin Friday in New Mexico and Texas, with the worst weather moving east into the deep south before heading up the coast and thumping New England and much of the eastern seaboard with heavy snow. Cold air streaming down from Canada caused public Chicago schools and Des Moines public schools to cancel classes for tomorrow. Wind chills predicted to be as low as minus 35 degrees Fahrenheit could cause frostbite within 10 minutes, making it too dangerous to walk to school or wait for the bus. The House has passed this year's final batch of spending bills. Lawmakers still smarting from last autumn's record 43-day government shutdown work to avoid another funding lapse for a broad swath of the federal government. Three of the bills had broad bipartisan support. They funded defense and various other departments, including education and health and human services. A fourth bill, funding the Department of Homeland Security, was hotly disputed as Democrats voiced concerns it failed to restrain President Trump's mass deportation efforts. The four bills now move to the Senate, with final passage needed before a January 30th deadline to avoid another partial government shutdown. Attorney General Pam Bondi says a woman who led an anti-immigration enforcement protest that disrupted a service at a Minnesota church has been arrested. Bondi announced online today that Nakima Levy Armstrong had been arrested. Protesters entered a St. Paul church on Sunday, where a U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement official serves as a pastor. The group interrupted services by chanting "ICE out" and "Justice for Renee Good." That's in reference to the 37-year-old woman who was fatally shot by an ICE officer in Minneapolis earlier this month. Levi Armstrong is a civil rights attorney and activist. She had called for the pastor affiliated with ICE to resign. Federal agents have taken a 5-year-old boy and his father from Minnesota to a detention facility in Texas. School officials and the family's lawyer say this is part of the immigration enforcement surge in the Twin Cities. The school superintendent in the Minneapolis suburb of Columbia Heights says federal agents took Liam Conejo Ramos from a running car in the family's driveway. She says his father is pursuing asylum in the U.S. The Department of Homeland Security says the operation targeted the father, not the child. It's not clear if the father asked for his son to be taken into custody with him. Liam is the district's fourth student who's been detained recently by ICE. Maine Governor Janet Mills challenged federal immigration officials to provide arrest warrants, real-time numbers, and information about detainees amid a sweeping enforcement operation, saying the state has been left in the dark as fear spreads in immigrant communities. Federal officials say about 50 arrests were made on the first day and that roughly 1,400 people are targets. Mills questioned those claims and said schools and businesses are being disrupted. Her remarks came as Cumberland County Sheriff Kevin Joyce criticized the arrest of a corrections officer recruit who'd been authorized to work in the United States, saying the case did not align with the immigration agency's stated focus on serious criminals. More from Ben Thomas.
The state of Maine has relatively few residents who are in the U.S. illegally, but in its largest cities, it does have a notable presence of refugees, and that's put it in the crosshairs of the Department of Homeland Security.
People are afraid. They are scared.
Pius Ali, Portland City Councilor.
Imagine you are a parent and you step out to put your kid in a school bus. By the time you turn around, you are surrounded by ICE agents.
Mark Dion is the mayor of Portland, which has thousands of residents of African descent.
While we respect the law, we challenge the need for a paramilitary approach for the enforcement of federal statutes.
ICE says it has about 1,400 targets in Maine and had made 50 arrests by Tuesday. I'm Ben Thomas.
A federal judge ruled today that the academics who are party to a lawsuit alleging U.S. policy singles out non-citizens for detention or deportation over their pro-Palestinian activism on college campuses can seek relief from the court if their immigration status is changed as retribution for taking part in the case. The ruling from U.S. District Judge William Young comes in the wake of trial last year in which he ruled the Trump administration violated the Constitution when it targeted non-U.S. citizens for deportation solely for supporting Palestinians and criticizing the Israeli government. Young repeatedly chastised the administration for violating the First Amendment rights of the plaintiffs and today issued what he described as remedial sanction to protect certain of the plaintiffs' non-citizen members from any retribution for the exercise of free speech or of constitutional rights. During the hearing in the case earlier this month, Young maintained that Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, and their agents had engaged in what he called unconstitutional conspiracy to limit the free speech of the plaintiffs, creating a chilling effect on the rights by their attempts to pick off certain people, in his words. He said, the big problem in this case is that the cabinet secretaries, ostensibly, and the president of the U.S. are not honoring the First Amendment. He continued, there doesn't seem to be an understanding of what the First Amendment is by this government. In his ruling, Young said that a non-citizen challenging his or her immigration status change would have to prove that they were a member of the American Association of University Professors and Middle East Studies Associations, the two groups that sued, between March of last year and September. They would also have to show their immigration status had not expired and had not committed any crime after September 30th of last year. The Associated Press says it's not aware of any members of these groups whose status has changed because they're part of the lawsuit. A spokesman for the Department of Homeland Security did not respond to a request for comment. During last year's trial, witnesses for the government acknowledged that the campaign targeted more than 5,000 pro-Palestinian protesters. Other witnesses for the plaintiffs testified to how the campaign stoked fear, among academics and prompted some of them to stop their activism. Among the cases that have fueled the lawsuit was that of former Columbia University grad student Mahmoud Khalil. Earlier this month, a federal appeals panel reversed a lower court decision that released Khalil from immigration jail, bringing the government one step closer to detaining and ultimately deporting Khalil. The U.S. has finalized its withdrawal from the World Health Organization 1 year after President Trump announced that the U.S. was ending its 78-year-old commitment, federal officials said today. But it's hardly a clean break. The U.S. owes more than $130 million to the Global Health Agency. That's according to the United Nations. And Trump administration officials acknowledged that they haven't finished working out some issues, such as lost access to data from other countries that could give America an early warning of a new pandemic. The withdrawal will hurt the global response to new outbreaks and will hobble the ability of U.S. scientists and pharmaceutical companies to develop vaccines and medicines against new illnesses or threats. The World Health Organization is the United Nations' specialized health agency and is mandated to coordinate the response to global health threats, such as outbreaks of Mpox, Ebola, and polio. It also provides technical assistance to poorer nations, helps distribute scarce vaccines, supplies aid and treatments, and sets guidelines for hundreds of health conditions, including mental health and cancer. Nearly every country in the world is a WHO member. On Wednesday, we aired part one of an interview that Background Briefing host Ian Masters did with Jason Elliott, a reporter with Politico, about his recent investigation, finding that Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem was funneling taxpayer money to herself and people close to her. Here's part two of that interview.
Advocates say Appalachian communities in Kentucky already facing longer wait times for FEMA reimbursement application processing would be negatively impacted by the cuts. FEMA workers are typically the first to provide boots-on-the-ground help to remote areas, including to provide essentials such as food, clothing, lodging assistance, and baby formula, says Dana Kuhnlein with Reimagine Appalachia.
A lot of the folks that they're looking to lay off from FEMA are the people who help facilitate disaster recovery and emergency preparedness.
Apologize for the technical difficulty. That was the wrong tape. But we will get you part two of that interview later in the newscast. The federal agency responsible for providing natural disaster assistance to states will likely see its workforce slashed by thousands of jobs, according to new leaks from federal workers. Nadia Romlagon has that story.
Advocates say Appalachian communities in Kentucky already facing longer wait times for FEMA reimbursement application processing would be negatively impacted by the cuts. FEMA workers are typically the first to provide boots-on-the-ground help to remote areas, including to provide essentials such as food, clothing, lodging assistance, and baby formula, says Dana Kuhnlein with Reimagine Appalachia.
A lot of the folks that they're looking to lay off from FEMA are the people who help facilitate disaster recovery and emergency preparedness. It's pretty concerning.
In 2025 alone, the state dealt with multiple disaster declarations, along with a deadly tornado, landslides, and mudslides. Kuhnlein adds that eastern Kentucky communities are still trying to recover from devastating flooding nearly three summers ago. A 2023 report from the Government Accountability Office found the agency lacked reliable hiring data and struggled with persistent hiring gaps. Regional workers employed through FEMA's CORE program make up a sizable portion of its workforce. Kuhnlein believes the staffing cuts will create even more barriers for residents who lack the local infrastructure and resources needed to deal with major disasters.
I don't want an Appalachian community to be the next Hurricane Katrina because we unraveled all of these safety nets that were put in place after that disaster.
Lawmakers recently sent a letter to President Donald Trump criticizing the decision by Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem to greenlight the job cuts. Additionally, the letter argues some of the policy changes the agency has undergone may be violating the post-Katrina Emergency Management Reform Act, which put in place guardrails aimed at ensuring disaster preparedness and response. This is Nadia Romlagon for Kentucky News Connection.
A man accused of offering a $10,000 bounty over Snapchat for the life of a top Border Patrol leader was found not guilty today in the first criminal trial stemming from the Chicago area immigration crackdown that started last year. Jurors deliberated more than 4 hours before returning the favorable verdict for Juan Espinoza Martinez. He faced one count of murder for hire and up to 10 years in prison if convicted. Testimony lasted mere hours in the federal trial that was the latest test of the Trump administration's credibility on federal surges that have played out from Minnesota to Maine. Espinoza Martinez listened intently with his arms crossed near his stomach. He hugged his attorneys and shook their hands after court adjourned. Attorneys for the defense declined to comment. Prosecutors did not address reporters waiting in the lobby of the federal court in downtown Chicago. Neither did jurors. At the heart of the government's case were Snapchat messages sent from Espinoza Martinez to his younger brother and a friend who turned out to be a government informant. One read in part, quote, 10,000 if you take him down, unquote, along with a picture of Gregory Bovino, a Border Patrol official who has led aggressive crackdowns nationwide, including in the Chicago area. But defense attorneys said the government didn't show any evidence against Espinoza Martinez, who sent the messages as neighborhood gossip after coming home from work and unwinding with beers. He didn't follow up on the exchanges and had only a few dollars in his bank account. In court, prosecutors accused Espinoza Martinez of being fixated and obsessed with Bovino and cited other messages where he criticized the crackdown. Espinoza Martinez was arrested in October as the city of 2.7 million and surrounding suburbs were seeing a surge of federal immigration officers. Protests and standoffs with agents were common, particularly in the city's heavily Mexican Little Village neighborhood where Espinoza Martinez lived. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney responded to President Trump's comment that, quote, Canada lives because of the United States, unquote, by saying that Canada thrives because of Canadian values.
When we're Canadian, inclusive, fair, ambitious, Canada grows. Canada and the United States have built a remarkable partnership in the economy, in security, and in rich cultural exchange. But Canada doesn't live because of the United States. Canada thrives because we are Canadian.
Carney says Canada can show the world that the future doesn't have to be autocratic after returning from Davos, where he gave a speech that garnered widespread attention. In Davos at the World Economic Forum, Carney condemned coercion by great powers on smaller countries without directly mentioning Trump. Upon returning home to Canada, Carney says his country, quote, can show that another way is possible, that the arc of history isn't destined to be warped toward authoritarianism and exclusion. It can still bend, he said, toward progress and justice. President Trump unveiled his new Board of Peace today, calling it something very, very unique for the world. It's part of the Gaza ceasefire deal he helped negotiate. But the board, which Trump himself chairs, has drawn skepticism from some, including many Gazan residents. Others fear Trump plans to use this new peace board to supplant the United Nations. Christopher Martinez has more.
President Donald Trump rolled out his Board of Peace in Davos, Switzerland, at a meeting of the World Economic Forum, where he said, we're going to be very successful in Gaza.
Of course, the war in Gaza, which is really coming to an end. We have little fires that we'll put out, but they're little. They were giant, giant, massive fires, and now they're down to little fires.
Although a peace panel was part of the agreement to end fighting in Gaza, Trump has plans far beyond that.
Once this board is completely formed, we can do pretty much whatever we want to do, and we'll do it in conjunction with the United Nations. There's tremendous potential with the United Nations, and I think the combination of the Board of Peace with the kind of people we have here, coupled with the United Nations, can be, you know, something very, very unique for the world.
Trump says 59 countries have lined up to join the Board of Peace, Albania for one, and countries that want to become permanent members of the board can do so if they agree to pony up $1 billion. But overall, Trump's announcement was short on details about how the board will work or how it will cooperate with the United Nations. International lawyer and mediator Nomi Bar-Yakov is among the skeptics.
I think it's a very serious problem because it is up to this Board of Peace, which is basically a one-man show. All the power lies with U.S. President Donald Trump, 100%, to decide what kind of relationship he would like to have with the U.N. so he can use them to help achieve his goals when he likes and not cooperate with when he does not.
She also has concerns about the makeup of the board.
Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel has said he would join, President Putin of Russia is mulling it over. Both of them have been indicted for war crimes by the International Criminal Court. So what kind of a board of peace is this? And I think this is a rhetorical question, but it's not just them. It's about the fact that this is a board of peace with a view of the world that money is the key factor in power.
Other skeptics include many Gaza residents who say they think Israel will still be in control. Many U.S. allies are also skeptical and have decided not to join the board, including the United Kingdom, France, Norway, and Sweden. And then there are concerns about the peace board being used to replace the UN with a body under Trump's control. In fact, the logo for the peace board is pretty similar to the UN logo, except instead of an image of the world between olive branches, there's an image of North America, along with a bit of South America, including Venezuela, which may have something to do with Elon Musk's remarks at the event.
I heard about the formation of the peace summit, and I was like, is that P-I-E-C-E? you know, a little piece of Greenland, a little piece of Venezuela.
As for the UN itself, it says it will cooperate with the Peace Board, but the Secretary General's spokesperson, Stéphane Dujarric, says the UN remains the only international organization with a universal membership. He says, we're continuing our work, we're keeping calm and carrying on. Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
And now we'll bring you that interview with Politico reporter Justin Elliott talking about his investigation and findings that Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem was funneling tax money to herself and people close to her. He starts by talking about the role of former ICE Deputy Director Madison Sheehan in the controversy.
Yes, this is Madison Sheehan, who's a, you know, not a household name, but somebody who's very important in Kristi Noem's orbit. She was essentially Kristi Noem's sort of body woman, like the person that would give her Diet Coke when she wanted one back when Kristi Noem was governor of South Dakota. Madison Sheehan's very young. She's in her late 20s. I think she's 28 or 29 now. And she rose very quickly from being Kristi Noem's personal aide to actually being the number two deputy head of ICE, which is a, you know, huge job, as you can imagine. She didn't have any real law enforcement experience to speak of. And what we found in the reporting for this story was that she actually had financial ties to this company, the strategy group that got part of the ad contract. She'd previously been paid by them for some work in South Dakota. And so, you know, another example of the kind of financial ties between Kristi Noem's people and this firm. And, you know, the way government contracting is supposed to work is you don't get to just give government contracts to your friends and allies if you're a politician. There's a whole, you know, extensive set of rules and regulations around fair competition and, you know, open bidding and this sort of thing. And so, you know, the government contracting experts we spoke to said the fact that this firm ended up being one of the ones doing the work here and getting the public money raises all sorts of questions about whether those rules were followed.
Well, when we talk about the ads, though, Justin, that Kristi Noem did out of this $220 million ad buy that had benefited the husband of the DHS spokesman, Tricia McLaughlin. It wasn't just that she was talking about we're securing our borders. She also said we're defending and protecting our culture, which is, I don't think there's any other way to interpret that except that it's completely racist. Isn't she referring to the idea that we want a white America, not we don't want a brown America?
I mean, look, certainly we've seen, I you know, what was in her heart with those particular comments, I obviously can't say, but we have seen the social media coming out of DHS, you know, I think has been pointed out by a lot of people as in, you know, been explicitly along those lines, like pictures of kind of white pioneer type families, you know, images like that evoke the 19th century with messages like, you know, take back what's ours, that sort of thing. So yes, it's the messaging coming out of DHS, I would say, is not subtle.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, Justin, in terms of giving our audience some sense that, I mean, they're already been terrorized, people are afraid, particularly, you know, families are being broken up, anybody's being picked up, in a lot of American citizens are picked up. In fact, we don't even know whether most of the people they round up end up being American citizens. There was an incident just the other day in Minneapolis where they grabbed a guy out of the car and the wife was pleading with the officers. You can see it on camera, saying, please don't shoot my husband. I need my husband to take care of the kids. The idea that we've come to that point is so shocking. But it seems to me that there's some evidence that the American people just are not going to tolerate this. I've seen evidence, for example, that companies, hotels, restaurants, etc., are putting up signs saying we will not serve ICE. So is there a way, do you think, for citizens in this country to object to the idea that they're paying for a bunch of thugs to terrorize them and possibly even shoot them?
You know, to me, obviously, how this administration responds to public opinion, I wouldn't bet on that one way or the other. It's very, very hard to predict how these things will play out. But I think the interesting thing to watch is Congress. You know, just this week, we saw articles of impeachment drafted, you know, by Democrats. So they're, of course, they don't control the House or Senate right now. But we articles of impeachment to impeach Kristi Noem drafted and actually cited our reporting on SAD contract, among other issues, including the ICE violence. So I think Congress's oversight role is going to be the key thing to watch, whether Congress plays a kind of robust oversight role under its current control. I think we don't know, but we've seen surprises out of Congress even in the last few weeks where not all Republicans in Congress are in lockstep with the Trump administration on issues like Venezuela, for example. So I think that's going to be an interesting thing to watch. I think if the Democrats take the House this year and you know, take the majority next year, as a reporter, that really changes, you know, the prospect of a opposition party, whether it's Democrats or Republicans, doing oversight on the White House. That can really change the game.
And that report, that was Justin Elliott from Politico. He spoke with Background Briefing host Ian Masters. It was part two of a two-part interview. Background Briefing airs weekdays on KPFA. And you are listening to the Pacifica Evening News on KPFA. I'm Max Pringle. This newscast airs each night at 6. Back with more news after this.
Hi, I'm Sergio Melnyshenko with the Global Village. Join me Fridays at 11 a.m. with music from around the world and around the block, as well as some very special interviews. Fridays from 11 to 1 p.m. right here on KPFK Los Angeles, 90.7 FM, also streaming on kpfk.org.
This is Gollum from Lord of the Rings, and you're listening to Precious KPFK 90.7 FM.
Governor Gavin Newsom today showed off knee pads that he suggested were for leaders selling out to the Trump administration. Speaking at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, Newsom said the red knee pads were available to buy via a website he'd created. On Tuesday, Newsom accused world leaders of rolling over for the Trump administration. A scheduled appearance by Governor Newsom at USA House, described on its website as an official U.S. venue at Davos, was said to have been canceled on Wednesday, soon after Trump addressed the forum. Newsom said the Trump administration is censoring any views it doesn't like.
They're censoring historical facts. They're rewriting history. They're censoring books, 4,340 books, libraries, and in schools, banned in the United States of America. You're watching institutions. Any institution of independent thinking is under assault and attack by the Trump administration. You're seeing what's playing out in the streets of American cities.
USA House is privately organized and does not represent the U.S. government. It is sponsored by large companies, including Microsoft, Pfizer, and blockchain company Ripple. Newsom is a potential 2028 Democratic presidential candidate and has sparred with President Trump in the past. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is criticizing European allies for their slow and fragmented response to Russia's invasion. Speaking at the World Economic Forum in Davos, he highlighted Europe's inadequate support compared to the U.S. push for peace. Sagar Magani has more.
For the former comedic actor,
everyone remembers the great American film Groundhog Day,
where Bill Murray's character relives the same day over and over. Ukrainians are too.
Repeating the same thing for weeks, months, and of course for years.
At the World Economic Forum, Zelensky made the same plea from last year, urging Europe to stand up as a global force. For now,
Europe looks lost.
The criticism came hours after Zelensky talked with President Trump.
The meeting was good. Look, we have a ways to go.
His special envoy was due to meet with Vladimir Putin in Moscow as the U.S. pushes a peace settlement. Sagar Magani, Washington.
The Alaska Federation of Natives, or AFN, is pulling out all the stops to block a Safari Club International proposal to reform the Federal Subsistence Board. As Rhonda McBride reports, AFN says it is a direct threat to the Alaska Native subsistence way of life.
Last year, Safari Club International, a sport hunting and fishing group, petitioned two Trump cabinet members for the review. It asked Interior Secretary Doug Burgum and Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins to address what it calls federal overreach in subsistence management. In December, the Interior Department granted the request and announced a 60-day review called a scoping process. During this time, it will consider the Safari Club's recommendations, which includes a proposal to limit the size of the Federal Subsistence Board to only the heads of five federal agencies. Ben Malott, president of the Alaska Federation of Natives, says this would eliminate public seats, including three held by tribal representatives.
We've been working for that for a very long time, so we are concerned that any rollback in public member seats would just weaken our voices. And so for us, that is a major threat.
But beyond changing the leadership structure of subsistence management, the Safari Club calls on federal agency heads when setting regulations to defer to state managers, a move that opponents say would undermine the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, or ANILCA, legislation Congress passed 45 years ago to protect Alaska's rural subsistence lifestyle. John Sturgeon, a leading advocate for the Alaska Safari Club, says this is a fight about fish and game management, not about the rights of rural Alaskans to subsist.
We have no problem with subsistence. We support it. So it's kind of a perceived conflict because we just think the state of Alaska should be the one that's in charge of subsistence.
The problem is the state's constitution does not allow for a rural subsistence priority, which federal law mandates. Public comment on the Safari Club proposals closes on February 13th. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
The temporary rules imposed after last year's collision of an airliner and an Army helicopter to improve the safety of the crowded airspace around Washington, D.C., are being made permanent. That's according to a government announcement today. The Federal Aviation Administration took steps to make sure that helicopters and planes would no longer share the same airspace around Reagan National Airport shortly after the investigation into the January 29, 2025 crash began. The rules also prohibit air traffic controllers from relying on visual separation and require all military aircraft to broadcast their locations. The National Transportation Safety Board plans to hold a hearing next Tuesday to detail everything that contributed to the deadliest air crash on American soil since 2001. The families of the 67 people who died after an Army Black Hawk helicopter struck an American Airlines jet that was preparing to land. Hope Duffy and Congress, Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy and Congress will act on the recommendations NTSB is expected to make next week to help prevent a similar tragedy in the future. Matt Collins, who lost his younger brother Chris in the disaster, said he and many of the other families plan to keep going to Washington so often that lawmakers will get sick of seeing them until changes are made. The FAA said the new final rule will take effect on Friday. It will continue to require military aircraft to broadcast their locations using their ADS-B out systems, which was routinely not done before the crash. And air traffic controllers are not allowed to rely on pilots to ensure visual separation between aircraft within 5 miles of Reagan Airport. The NTSB has said that the Black Hawk helicopter in the crash was flying about 78 feet higher than the 200-foot limit on the route and likely had a faulty altimeter. But even if the helicopter had been adhering to that limit, the NTSB has said the route design didn't provide nearly enough separation to ensure safety. Air traffic controllers had warned the FAA years beforehand about the dangers of all the helicopters around the nation's capital, and the agency failed to recognize an alarming pattern of 85 near misses in the 3 years before the crash. Collins said he still flies often for work and pleasure, but his parents haven't boarded a plane since the tragedy. President Trump is suing J.P. Morgan Chase and its CEO, Jamie Dimon, for $5 billion. He alleges the bank closed his accounts for political reasons after he left office in January of 2021. The lawsuit filed in Miami-Dade County Court claims J.P. Morgan abruptly closed multiple accounts in February 2021, giving 60 days notice without explanation. Trump says this cut him off from millions and disrupted his businesses. J.P. Morgan, in a statement, expressed regret over the lawsuit but denied political motives. A spokesperson said the suit lacks merit, emphasizing accounts are closed for legal or regulatory risks, not political ones. A bill to ban the sale of assault weapons and high-capacity magazines is one of several anti-gun violence proposals previously vetoed by Virginia's Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin that could become law this year under Democratic Governor-elect Abigail Spanberger. More from Simone Perez.
The bill would mean any person who sells, imports, manufactures, purchases, or transfers an assault weapon manufactured after July 1st would be charged with a Class 1 misdemeanor. The same goes for magazines that hold, or could be modified to hold, more than 10 rounds of ammunition. Delegate Dan Helmer reintroduced the bill following two previous vetoes from former Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin in 2024 and 2025. Helmer, an Army veteran, says the bill targets weapons and magazines commonly used in mass shootings.
Since 2020, I've been working to ban weapons like those I carried in Iraq and Afghanistan from being trafficked in Virginia to keep high-capacity magazines off of our streets. These are the weapons that are most often used in the most extreme mass shootings.
Youngkin, who has vetoed a number of pieces of gun regulation legislation, argued such laws violated the constitutional rights of Virginians to keep and bear arms. A poll last year from Everytown for Gun Safety found more than 70% of Commonwealth residents supported a ban on assault weapons, and 90% supported background checks for all gun sales. Helmer says he's excited to get the bill to newly inaugurated Democratic Governor Abigail Spanberger's desk. Spanberger has long called for a ban on high-capacity magazines.
We have a chance to take weapons of war off our streets and make sure that our kids aren't under fire in our schools, that our communities aren't treated like war zones, and that we are safe.
A 2025 study by Everytown found states with stronger gun laws had lower rates of gun deaths than states with weaker laws. States with the fewest gun restrictions had a rate of gun deaths more than 2 times higher than the states with the most. This story was produced with original reporting from Josh Israel for the Virginia Independent. I'm Simone Perez, Virginia News Connection.
European leaders hit back at criticism from President Trump this week at the Davos World Economic Forum in Switzerland. Sigur Bjorn has more.
In light of President Trump's growing determination to acquire Greenland by any means necessary, including a possible hostile militarized takeover, European leaders are hardening their own stance, falling firmly in line behind both Denmark and its autonomous protectorate. On a day when Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen said she will, quote, not abandon Greenland, unquote, political leaders in Europe have stepped up their rhetoric towards the United States and its president to levels not heard between the Allies since the onset of the Cold War and the formation of NATO in 1949. Speaking today at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, the European Commission's president, Ursula von der Leyen, reaffirmed the Commission's support for Denmark.
And this is why we are working on a package to support Arctic security. First principle, full solidarity with Greenland and the Kingdom of Denmark. The sovereignty and integrity of their territory is non-negotiable.
Also at the summit, French President Emmanuel Macron warned against what he termed new imperialism and criticized, quote, the useless aggressivity, unquote, of the United States. These words go even further than yesterday's rhetoric from European leaders, who balked at the proposed 10% tariff increase President Trump threatened to impose on 8 nations who showed solidarity with the Danes, including France, the UK, and Denmark's Nordic neighbors, Sweden and Norway. The 10% tariff is set to be put in place by February 1st and will then increase to 25% by July 1st and remain so until the US takeover of Greenland is finalized. Iceland, Greenland's closest neighbor, was somewhat surprisingly left off this list of 8, but words from the country's Prime Minister, Kristrún Frostadóttir, may yet turn the 8 into 9. Frostadóttir said during parliamentary questions time she would, quote, not budge an inch in her support for Greenland, unquote, calling the US president's stance unacceptable. Iceland is one of several European nations that have deployed defensive personnel to Greenland in response to the escalating situation to emphasize how seriously they take the island's security and its self-governance. Meanwhile, European leaders are mulling over a response to those tariff threats, which may include the so-called Anti-Coercion Instrument, or ACI. The ACI, also known as the Bazooka Option, was put in place by the European Commission as a response to aggressive actions from China towards one of its member states. But it could be activated against the US if it does not soften its stance. The Bazooka Option would restrict the ability of US corporations to sell products to the European Union, which is the biggest economical bloc in the world. It's a move that experts warn would have far-reaching and long-lasting consequences for all stakeholders. Here is French President Emmanuel Macron expressing his readiness to implement the anti-coercion instrument in Davos today.
Europe has very strong tools now, and we have to use them when we are not respected, and when the rules of the game are not respected, by the way. The anti-coercion mechanism is a powerful instrument. and we should not hesitate to deploy it in today's tough environment.
The more cautious among European leaders have emphasized that the bazooka option is an emergency tool only. That said, the European Parliament today suspended a vote on a landmark transatlantic trade deal negotiated in 2025 to lower or eliminate tariffs on most US goods in the European Union. Here is Ursula von der Leyen again, speaking in Davos today.
The proposed additional tariffs are a mistake, especially between long-standing allies. The European Union and the United States have agreed to a trade deal last July. And in politics, as in business, a deal is a deal. And when friends shake hands, it must mean something.
Meanwhile, the Greenlandic nation continues its quiet defiance in the face of threats to its independent existence. The country may be the world's biggest island, but it's a nation of only 57,000 people, most of them of native Inuit origin. Mass protests have been staged both in the country's capital of Nuuk and in Copenhagen in Denmark, where a quarter of all Greenlanders live. But underneath this defiance is fear for what the future may hold and also bewilderment at the escalation of the situation they see as entirely unnecessary. This is because the United States already has a treaty with Greenland and Denmark, signed in 1951, that has allowed the country to have a military presence on the island. It will come as no surprise to Native Americans that the relationship between the Inuit Islanders of Greenland with Denmark has a very complicated history, but it's a resolute will of the people there to remain a self-governing protectorate of the kingdom, rather than the 51st state of the U.S. Greenland's Prime Minister Jens Frederik Nielsen reiterated this to loud cheers during a protest he addressed in Nuuk 2 days ago. But Nielsen, like other leaders in the region, is coming to the realization that they are living in an unprecedented time where the current world order seems to be unraveling. And today he said he could not rule out the possibility of the U.S. attacking Greenland. In Reykjavik, Iceland, I'm Sigur Bjørn, reporting for Pacifica.
Thousands of federal agents continue operations in Minnesota. The ripple effects are being felt here in the Bay Area. Today, more than 200 local faith leaders and community activists gathered on the steps of San Francisco City Hall to begin a 24-hour fast to protest what they say are harsh ICE tactics, like deploying chemical agents on protesters. KPFA's health and wellness reporter Annetta Felix was there and has this report.
Nearly 50 people sat cross-legged on the steps of the San Francisco City Hall Thursday in meditative silence and a solidarity 24-hour fast in response to ICE operations in Minnesota and across the country. One of the participants, Beth Sosa, is a retired teacher of 20 years.
ICE is not doing what ICE was intended to do. They're doing something completely different, and they're violating the Constitution and everybody's rights. The aspiration was liberty and justice for all. This is going the very wrong direction.
The protest is a response to the deployment of 3,000 ICE officers in the Twin Cities. But beyond the arrests, a growing concern is the use of chemical irritants. Unverified images from Minnesota show federal agents deploying a thick green gas, a variant of tear gas reported to be more toxic than standard formulations. Dr. Haruni Ha from the University of California, Berkeley, has been analyzing the psychological and physiological toll of these agents.
Tear gas and pepper spray, what we call chemical irritants, when they target individuals, those harms rapidly escalate. These chemical irritants can injure any different part of your body, everything from the tears, obviously in your eyes, to a lot of skin injuries, lung injuries, and mucosal injuries to your mouth, your lungs. But also those canisters can cause serious harm as well.
Dr. Ha says the impact of these weapons extends far beyond the physical.
You have people who were involved in the protest, especially those who were injured. There's high levels of stress, anxiety, and sometimes post-traumatic stress-like syndromes. And that's because the experience of being in these protests where they're exposed to a lot of these weapons can feel almost militaristic and really dangerous and scary.
For Shannon Cheng, a layperson in the Lutheran community, these reports and the images accompanying them are what drove her to join the pro-peace vigil.
It's terrifying, it's sad. I have immigrant family members and biracial children, and so I think of my own family. I think of how, you know, we're relatively lucky to be here in San Francisco and how many families are, you know, don't have the privileges and protections that my family do. So really terrified and sad for everyone.
Faith leaders at City Hall say they're using their bodies to be a witness. Muslim organizer Reverend Ranwa Hamami says that 200 people signed up to the fast. She adds that for her, the fast is more than just skipping meals.
So many faith traditions use fasting as a way to clarify our intentions and to deepen our understanding of what we are called to do. And so a fast allows us to connect deeper with our faith, connect us deeper to what we as people of whatever faith are asked to do in this moment when we're witnessing violence, when we're witnessing the destruction of our communities. A fast allows us to really focus our attention on that.
Reverend Bruce Reyes Chow of the Interfaith Movement for Human Integrity says the fast is a public witness to demand accountability for ICE's actions.
Fast is a spiritual discipline for me. It is a personal reminder of the things that may hold me back from experiencing the world. It's a public witness to the world that we are doing things in the world that hold us back from experiencing the beauty and the wonder of God. And right now, what ICE is doing in the world is holding the world back from experiencing the fullness of humanity. And so we fast together as a public witness to tell people that what ICE is doing right now is simply wrong. And so we have to stop.
For Shulamit Wise Fairman of the Kehila Synagogue clergy team, the fast is a necessary spiritual practice.
My fast began shortly before noon today in solidarity with the call that we received. And I will fast until noon tomorrow when we rally outside the immigration court in San Francisco.
I send my prayer.
I send my strength.
I send my strength to the Lord Jesus.
The fast gathering ended with a song sending prayers to people affected by ICE operations everywhere across the country. I'm Annetta Felix, reporting for KPFA Radio.
An appeal for bankruptcy protection filing of the operator of Saks Fifth Avenue, Bergdorf Goodman and Neiman Marcus, has left the luxury department store's suppliers with unpaid bills and caused a rift with Amazon, one of Saks Global minority investors. Saks Global said last week it had secured roughly $1.75 billion to help finance the company through legal proceedings and toward hoped-for profitability. The company said it would honor all customer loyalty programs, compensate vendors, and continue to pay employees while seeking approval for its plan to satisfy its outstanding liabilities, which range from $1 billion to $10 billion, according to court documents. TikTok has finalized a deal to create a new American entity, avoiding the looming threat of a ban in the U.S. that has been in discussion for years. The social video platform company signed agreements with major investors including Oracle, Silver Lake, and MGX to form the joint venture. The new version will operate under, quote, defined safeguards, with an emphasis on data protections and software assurances for U.S. users. The company said in a statement today, the establishment of a U.S. unit marks the end of years of uncertainty about the fate of the popular video sharing platform in the United States. Clear tonight in the San Francisco Bay Area, lows in the 40s. Tomorrow, clear, highs in the 50s. In the Central Valley, clear tonight, lows in the 40s. Tomorrow, clear, highs in the 50s. In the Los Angeles area, clear tonight, overnight, lows in the 40s. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs in the 60s. That's it for the news today. I'm Max Pringle. EA is at the controls. Good evening.
Listener support comes in many forms. And now, there's one more way to give back. You can donate land or real estate to KPFK and help keep public media strong for future generations. We handle the process from start to finish, and your donation may qualify for a significant tax deduction. Turn your property into something meaningful. Visit kpfk.org/real estate or call 844-277-4663 to learn more.
Hi, this is Robbie Krieger from The Doors, and you are listening to Fiercely Independent KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles 98.7.